David A. Price presents... Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 312. With my quarantine lifted, I'm your host, Steve Raker, making noise at you from the comic book bunker, along with WWX Kevin and Andrew the LA Rabbit. Kevin, Andrew, and honestly everyone, my utmost apologies for what's turned out to be the longest hiatus between Marvel Noise episodes ever. It's been like a month, guys, and... it's completely my fault. My whole household was ill with strep infections for a couple of weeks, and with my vestibular addled head, I don't do that well with stuffiness or phlegm-filled sinuses and crevices, so I couldn't even read or be productive in any way, but I'm on the other side now, so we can get on with it.
When they talk about those AIM helmets, wow, that really,
I could have used an AIM helmet.
We know it was really the legacy virus, Steve. I don't know why
here. Not again, the legacy virus. Well, Marvel Noise, we are an independent podcast, proudly sponsored by nobody, but we're happy to be part of the podcasting machine that is the Deliberate Noise Network, benevolently run by Grand Poobah Derek Howard, whose flagship show is Comic Book Noise. Our sister show is Indie Comic Book Noise, where various configurations of our cast here at Marvel Noise talk about the indie books we're digging on. And you can download and stream episodes past and present of Marvel Noise from marvelnoise.com via the episode archive. The topic for this episode, it was supposed to be like a clever choice for an April Fool's episode, but April Fool's, it's not out until almost May. But what we're looking at is the Marvel vs. DC event from 1996 and 7. And Marvel vs. DC was edited by Mark Gruenwald and Mike Carlin. Mike Carlin had been Gruenwald's assistant editor back in the 80s before becoming DC's editor-in-chief. Like, remember Assistant Editors Month, guys? That was out of
Hembeck. I remember the Hembeck knees and all that.
That was all out of the Gru Carlin office. And I think we've only briefly mentioned the Assistant Editors Month when I covered Marvel's parody comics way back on Marvel Noise episode 131 from October 13th, 2010. And you can find those archives on marvelnoise.com via the sidebar calendar pull-down menu thingy. So the Marvel vs. DC... we had issues 1 and 3 be published by DC, called DC vs. Marvel, written by Ron Mars with art by Dan Jurgens and Joe Rubinstein. And then issues 2 and 4 were published by Marvel, called Marvel vs. DC, written by Peter David with art by Claudio Castellini and Paul Neary. Plus, there was a DC vs. Marvel Fleer Skybox trading card set in 1995 that kicked off the event, which me and Kevin covered sometime in the past when we talked about the Marvel trading cards of the 90s. It was Marvel Noise episode 280 from October 10th, 2016. Well, DC vs. Marvel opens with Spidey, but it's the Ben Reilly Spidey. And he even gets called out for wearing a costume, but not the costume, which was a nice touch.
Did you vote though, Steve? Weren't you supposed to send your ballots in or something?
At the end of the first issue, they had a ballot system that you for some big matchups that would take place in the third issue. So you had 2 months to send them in and choose the outcome. Marvel, of course, came out on top.
Yeah. Hey, I still have an AOL address, so I can relate there.
Oh, dear.
I'm not even sure what the... I like have a ballot still hanging around, and I'm always like, did this come from inside the issue, or was there like extra ballots at the comic shop? Because I'm not even sure how I found out about this series to like pre-order it in time or anything. Like,
I think there were promotional ballots that, you know, would be in a stack of cards next to the register or something like that at the LCS, you know. But Spidey gets transported to the DCU, and he's like, what's a Gotham? He runs into the Joker, which I thought this was another nice touch. The Joker recognizes Spidey from past Superman-Spider-Man crossovers.
So what?
But this is the Ben Reilly Spidey who never met the Joker or Superman, so the recognition is completely lost on him, but as fans, we're in the know.
I gotta say, I'm not a 90s guy, as everyone knows, and I'm probably gonna make a lot of unflattering comments, but I did think the Joker was well, like, out of all the characters, I thought the Joker looked the most classic, least sort of 90s. It didn't, like, he didn't have super crazy musculature,
right?
Or those weird legs and everything. So good on them for getting the Joker right.
Or like long hair,
mullets.
There's lots of matchups shown in this first issue. Some just in a panel on like a mosaic 2-page spread, like Steel versus the Absorbing Man, and Green Lantern versus Green Goblin, Cap versus Bane, Daredevil versus the Riddler.
Boy, that Daredevil image too. Don't let Kevin see that. He's not going to be thrilled with how those. I'm not sure how those elbows are working, Steve.
The Punisher versus Deathstroke, the Terminator. That's a good matchup. Superman versus Annihilus, and Spidey versus Man-Bat, and some of the matchups, they showed in actual sequences, like the Spider-Man versus the Joker, and then we also get a kind of a nice sequence of Batman and Robin versus Bullseye. And like Kevin said, the first issue ends with the official ballot that you could vote on the outcomes of Batman versus Cap, Hulk versus Superman, Superboy versus Spider-Man, Wolverine versus Lobo, and Wonder Woman versus Storm. The fans will decide.
I think we have to decide right here. What?
I'm just glad they didn't put Robin in there, because Robin would have definitely died. Like the other write-in campaign.
So would you have voted for someone different now than you would have voted back then?
That's a good question. I think Wonder Woman certainly got a lot more clout than she used to. And I was thinking that in one of the later matchups, they show Elektra versus the Catwoman, and Elektra mops the floor with her. And I'm like, I wonder with the amount of gravitas they've put into Catwoman in the last few years, if they would have let it happen like that, if they did this now.
I think you'd have to have a link, though, to explain who Lobo is nowadays.
Wow.
Certainly they're not going to recognize this Lobo, the big, muscular, beefy guy than they would.
And
but you
weird.
Also forgot it's crossed over with Transformers, Steve, because the two brothers look an awful lot like Transformer characters.
Or Shogun
Warriors.
Like,
if you have Peter Parker versus Superboy, does that change your outcome?
Yeah, this isn't exactly the Superboy of my youth. It's the Cadmus clone post-death of Superman Superboy, you know?
Well, I know this is Kev's Thor, but it's certainly not my Thor when we get to him. Holy cow.
So there's the idea of the book, basically, that drives the story is that there's this alleyway carton box that is a portal between the two universes, the Marvel Universe and the DC Universe. And this box sports two guardians, more like caretakers. They really don't seem capable of guarding against any kind of threats, but they're these two blue-collar guys. And in fact, DC versus Marvel is foreshadowed in the 1995 Green Lantern Silver Surfer crossover written by Ron Mars, where the final panels of that one-shot show an alleyway with a large cardboard box emitting energies. So this is a direct continuation of that.
So if you walk down the alley, you go to Marvel, and if you walk up the alley, you go to DC? No, how does that work?
And it's funny, before the rest of Marvel editorial sales or production were told about the project, writers Ron Mars and Peter David joined DC editor Mike Carlin and Marvel editor Mark Gruenwald at Gruenwald's place and hatched up the whole plan for this event, breaking story and figuring out matchups and divvying up the writing responsibilities before they sort of brought it to their uppers to clear it. They hatched the idea of these two cosmic sentinel shogun warrior transformer type beings that represent the two universes. One's red and one's blue, although each has an aspect of the other in them, kind of like a cosmic yin-yang dynamic thing going on. These monolithic cosmic brothers had forgotten about the existence of the other, but no longer. They've learned of each other, and they've decided that they are joining, which is totally freaking out the Living Tribunal and the Spectre, who are each identified as their universe's guardians. The second and the third issues show us Wolverine versus Killer Croc, Thanos meeting Darkseid, or Darkseid, however you like it, Bane trying to break Cap's back, but he gets taken out by Cap's shield that he, like, flung beforehand. He's like, no, I break your back, and all of a sudden the shield, you know, as expected, ricochets off something perfectly and takes Bane out from behind. Captain Marvel versus Thor, I thought that's a good matchup, and whoa, I thought it was cool how they kneel and kind of give each other homage before they start going crazy on each other.
Now you guys need to brace me. This is not a Thor I'm used to, with the chain on the handle and the heavy metal hair and the shoulder pads and everything.
Yeah,
what was going on with Thor in 1996? And why does he look like this?
It's Warren Ellis and Mike Diodato is what was going on with Thor. He's got no shirt.
I mean, the shoulder pads are the one that I think that... Yeah, very metal. I was not... I mean, I did enjoy the Peter Parker, Clark Kent, Lois Lane love triangle they work on. Like, that provided some humor. There are some fun, like, the side stories are the parts I like more. And, like, Wonder Woman lifts up Thor's hammer. Like, that type of stuff is fun. But, yeah, some of the 90s of it really gets me in the face.
There's a lot of matchups, too, that you would expect, like Submariner versus Aquaman, right? Flash versus Quicksilver.
The Aquaman. Like, the Aquaman that I know is in here.
Thank goodness. He doesn't have a hook on his hand, though? No harpoon hand?
He does.
All right.
He does.
Flash versus Quicksilver, right? Silver Surfer versus the Kyle Rayner Green Lantern, which I thought was kind of neat because they referenced that they just recently teamed up, so they're reluctantly fighting each other, which was cool. You know, Wolverine versus Lobo, of course. The voted-on matchups from that issue one ballot. And then there's Jubilee versus Robin.
I love that one. I like to add a romance. That was another nice twist. They had a little romance going on. I thought that was cool.
The two characters that look exactly alike, male and female versions of each other. Yeah, they kind of have a crush on each other. After the universes combined in the finale of issue 3, we fans were treated to 12 amalgam comics titles. The universes and characters have combined. And the amalgam universe is Earth 9602, as per the 2005 official handbook of the Marvel Universe Alternate Universes. But DC never gave it a designation. And once this crossover was going well, and the amalgam angle was presented to the creative teams, Ron Mars, who was writing the regular title, said, I've got to do the Doctor Strange Fate book. How could you not want to do that book? He wanted dibs on that. And then afterwards gets Garcia Lopez and Kevin Nolan to do the art chores on that book, and he was happy as a clam, although kind of nervous that, you know, Jose Garcia Lopez was going to be drawing his stuff. That ended up being an important book, though, that sort of carried on some of the threads from the main title. There were 6 Marvel and 6 DC books in the first wave of amalgam titles. They were all published the same week, with all of the company's regular shipping titles suspended for that week in 1996. Cleverly the Amalgam books say that they're edited by the amalgamed M.M. Carwald, who even had his own checklist page soapbox. And the letters pages, they act as if, you know, this Amalgam Comics company has existed since the Golden Age and gone through all of these decades of history. They're really clever.
How did you feel about
being the thing?
In the main thing, they have Batman, which makes sense, as like the lead guy, but Captain America is the lead for the Marvel. And I thought that was interesting. I mean, I guess it made sense, but I wouldn't have necessarily, like I said, I clearly see Batman being the smart guy of the DC universe, but Cap, I don't know. I don't know if they did it today, if Cap would be the man.
Well, they were both wise enough of characters, right? So that they're fighting each other to a standstill. They're realizing we could do this all day, but they're both thinkers and strategizers. If I may have just made up a word there, but you know, it kind of made sense that they would stop their aggressions and sort of start thinking about, well, what's the bigger picture here? You know, Cap's been on enough Avengers missions where there's big stuff going on and, you know, certain sequences are falling into place and there's just many dynamics at play. And obviously, Batman's the detective, right? So it was kind of cool, I thought, that they were the two who said, let's shake hands and let's figure out what's what here.
Oh, like I said, I definitely think Batman's also the most popular and has been and continues to be, but I wonder if they'd want, like, a more popular guy than Cap for the lead for Marvel if it was today.
You think Spider-Man's patience? You know what I mean? Spider-Man would be too busy wisecracking and feeling guilty. But, yeah, I know what you mean. Who is that character for Marvel?
Moon Knight? No, I got it. We can have the Batman, the Nighthawk be the guy.
There you go.
No, so they can match off evenly. And I thought that, yeah, you're right about the long hair, like long hair Superman. I kind of forgot some of these 90s dudes, the way they have them. It seemed like a very metal, heavy metal time in comic books.
That and a little desperation, I think. But the DC books, the six DC books, were Doctor Strange Fate, written by Ron Mars, with art, as I said, by Jose Garcia Lopez and Kevin Nolan. And this was the only Amalgam title that I feel like you really had to read as part of the event.
Whoops.
It's Doctor Strange Fate. I mean, who wouldn't read Doctor Strange Fate?
Apparently not me.
Oh, boy. Well, it featured Access, who is the character, one of the Guardians, who is protecting the box in the alleyway. He's trying to restore the Marvel and DC universes. He knows what's going on with the brothers and all that. And Doctor Strange Fate is actually the villain of the piece. He's trying to stop Access and maintain the Amalgam status quo. And it's kind of cool. Doctor Strange Fate is Charles Xavier. So he's one powerful dude.
I kept confusing him with the Muppet character, Dr. Julius Strange Pork.
Strange Pork.
From Pigs in Space.
Not Dr. Strange Love.
But it's a fun... The other one I liked about this is I got all these. Like, you know, it was Wanda the Scarlet Witch and Zatanna. And like Frankie Ray and like the Guy Gardner type. Right, because weren't they the mashup, and then Bruce Banner was also involved. So like they were the henchmen, and I kind of could like some of these characters I don't know that well, but these were all ones I felt.
Well, the book I was stuck on was Assassins. It's written by D.G. Chichester with art by Scott McDaniel and Derek Fisher, and it's supposed to be the street level book of like Daredevil and Elektra merged with. The girl with the white hair and the patch over one eye has got to be like Deathstroke's daughter, the other Terminator, right?
But yes, I would say.
But who's the black girl who is combined with Elektra there? I don't know who she was. That one was lost.
I didn't
on
know
me.
If she was supposed to be. Isn't there? I wondered if she was the the Justice League character that has the animal brooch.
Oh.
Maybe. I'm not a DC guy, but that was my thought.
Yeah,
maybe. I can't remember the character's name, but you know, I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Vixen, you know.
Right.
Vixen, yeah, that was it. Because she seemed kind of like, oh, that could be a mix-up thing. But I thought that would be kind of also, you know, it also had some of like, had X-Man was in it. I mean, mixed up with...
oh, boy.
90s. With Chase, which I thought, is that Vigilante? Wasn't that Chase? Was he
yes.
Vigilante?
Yes.
So that was what that was. So this was another one where it's like Andy's trying to test, go back in the DC Wayback Machine and see which I can remember. Because I don't know that Vigilante's been much part of the newer DC in the last few reboots.
He was a tortured soul. At least the original one.
Man, those Alan Moore ones are pretty, the Father's Day one. Those are some good books, but they are... They're pretty grim, I'll give you that.
There was also Legends of the Dark Claw, written by Larry Hama, with art by Jim Ballant and Ray McCarthy. That is a Batman-Wolverine mashup. But it also had Jubilee as Robin, and a Carol Danvers Huntress, who was a pretty cool character. Amazon, from John Byrne and Terry Austin, who is a Wonder Woman Storm combo. And she was the adopted sister of Diana Prince on Paradise Island, and she... gets the opportunity to go to, the world of men. More on Diana in a few minutes. There was The JLX. That was written by Gerard Jones and Mark Wade with art by Howard Porter and John Dell. This was obviously...
Oh, I think I bought this one, too.
A JLA X-Men mashup. My favorite being the Nightcrawler-Creeper combo called Night Creeper. I love when the Ditko characters get combined. Super Soldier was the sixth book from DC, written by Mark Waid and Dave Gibbons, with art by Dave Gibbons. And this is a Superman-Captain America combo with an origin that I just love. The Kryptonian ship crashes to Earth. There are no survivors, but the government harvests the DNA from the dead alien baby and uses it to make the Super Soldier serum. Makes perfect sense, right? Marvel... had six books also. Bruce Wayne, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., written by Chuck Dixon, with art by Cary Nord and Mark Pennington, versus Lord Greenskull. And this one had the Moon Knight Nightwing mashup. Moonwing.
That seemed like a character that had some legs to it and could have gone on after this.
Also, Speed Demon, written by Howard Mackey and James Felder, with art by Salvador LaRocca and Al Milgram, that combined the Ghost Rider, Flash, and Etrigan the Demon, versus a Green Goblin, who ends up being Two-Face underneath. Bullets and Bracelets was written by John Ostrander, with art by Gary Frank and Cam Smith. This had Diana Prince, who didn't become Wonder Woman because of Aurora. So she teams up with Trevor Castle, and they are like a Punisher duo.
But they were a couple, and then they're broken apart, and they're teaming up to get after their offspring. But then they have the fun Dark Side Thanos mashup guy.
Right, Thanos side. And a Big Barda Titana mashup. Big Titania. I liked her. She had a cool look.
And Granny Harkness. Yeah, it was a fun, like... Let's take these
Granny
two.
Harkness.
I think the Dark Side Thanos universe was kind of fun to push together. Although maybe they're a little too similar, and visually, I mean.
X-Patrol was written by Carl and Barbara Kessel, with art by Roger Cruz and John Holridge. And this was an X-Force Teen Titans Doom Patrol amalgamized team with one of my favorite mashup names, Shatter Starfire. And Paige Guthrie was Dial H for Husk, which I also like. She would dial up and then peel off her husk. And they fought Dr. Doomsday.
And I liked Lobo the Duck, too, Steve. You gotta have that one.
Magneto and his Magnetic Men, written by Gerard Jones and Mark Wade, with art by Jeff Matsuda and Art Tiebert. This was a Metal Men Brotherhood of Evil Mutants combo. and Spider-Boy, which was Carl Kesel, Mike Waringo, and Gary Martin. And this was a Spider-Man Superboy combo, but also had a Fantastic Four Challengers of the Unknown combination, the Challengers of the Fantastic in this book. And they fight Bizarnage, a bizarro carnage combo. I also like that they referenced the Phantom Negative Zone.
Also seems hard to... That Challenger of the Unknown, they pretty much were the Fantastic
Four.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like mashing up Doom Patrol and X-Men. It really isn't much.
Whoa, they're not the same.
There was also a line at this time in 96 from Fleer and Skybox, a line of amalgam trading cards. I thought this was clever because not only did they give you a little more background on some of the characters and have additional amalgamations like the Red Tornado and the Vision and stuff like that, but they also referenced different events from Amalgam's rich publishing history that never existed, like the Secret Crisis of the Infinity Hour that combined Secret Wars, Crisis on Infinite Earths, Infinity Gauntlet, and Zero Hour. That I thought that was funny. In the finale, Marvel vs. DC issue number 4, Axis's plan to restore the universes by hiding shards of each universe within Darkclaw and Super Soldier so that Doctor Strange Fate couldn't find them ends up being successful, with the help of the Spectre and the Living Tribunal, of course. The series ends up finishing out with Superman helping the Hulk against the Mole Man, Superboy helping Spider-Man against the Kingpin, Wolverine helping Lobo against Thanos, and then it's everybody versus Thanos and Darkseid, except for Robin and Jubilee, who end up, like, kissing each other in Venice for their last shot.
Hey, Tim Drake deserves a little break.
And the Universal Brothers themselves clash and end up shaking hands and saying that the other one has done well. Give each other
that part.
Little thumbs
that
up.
That ending. I mean, I enjoyed this ride, but I don't know. How'd you feel about ending with the handshake? I don't know how you end this, but that seemed...
Right. Well, it's funny because originally, one hero from each universe was supposed to remain in the other. But by the time they got to the end, they chickened out. What they were going to do was swap green characters. The Martian Manhunter was going to stay in the Marvel Universe, essentially adding like a Superman-class character. And the She-Hulk was going to go to the DC Universe, who, you know, is somewhat redundant in the Marvel Universe, but adds a Hulk to DC.
Oh, nice. That would have been cool. But I guess the licensing, yeah, who would have, especially nowadays, that wouldn't fly. Mess up the movies.
Access also gets mentioned later in 1996 by the Impossible Man in the George Perez, Ron Lim, Terry Austin, Superman, Silver Surfer crossover. The following years, the companies would figure out a way to keep things going with this shared character, Access, between these universes with a 4-issue DC Marvel All Access Limited series in 1997, written by Ron Mars, with art by Jackson Butch Geis and Joe Rubenstein, published by DC. The first issue has Access being identified as having the task of keeping the two universes separate to prevent the amalgam from ever happening again. Axel Access's date gets broken up when he has a vision of Venom landing in the DCU.
Mm.
And Venom faces off against Superman, who can only seem to fight him to a standstill and cause a lot of property damage along the way. Access's only power, though, is to travel between the universes, but he can also transport anyone he's making physical contact with. So he goes and gets Spider-Man, now in his old costume, which seems new to Superman, because he just saw the other guy, the Ben Reilly, and now they're fighting Venom, and Venom's basically another Spider-Man costume, so, you know how it gets with continuity.
Well, also, that whole, like, how was Superman having a problem with Venom again?
Right.
That part never didn't really... I better go get Spider-Man. I would have just hoped, I don't know, maybe they could have brought like a magic character, like someone that's more believable to give Superman a hard time. His weakness to magic.
Yeah, but wasn't Superman like depowered when he came back after the Death of Superman thing for a while? Like until he went into that electricity blue and red versions of himself, then he was more powered after that. Like I think he lost some of his mojo for a while. Yeah, you know, they've been struggling for what to do with Superman, right? As far, they maybe we'll kill him, maybe we'll grow his hair long and try to make him cool that way. Maybe we'll make him into a electrical bolt. Maybe we'll depower him. It's what the editors and writers have been struggling with Superman for decades.
Yeah, but there's depowered and there's deep. I mean, Venom is not.
I know.
I mean, you give Spider-Man a hard time, but that's about the level of where you want to put him on the. I don't know. I just feel like there could have been. Even Carnage, I think, would have made more sense, maybe, as a tougher bad guy.
Superman gives access his cape to prove, you know, that the message is coming from Superman and sends him to Star Labs. And Axel returns with a sonic blaster to take out Venom and then return the spider beings to the Marvel U. In the second issue, Axel Axis's next date is interrupted by Jubilee, who convinces Axis to send her to the DCU so she can properly say goodbye to Robin since they hit it off so well. And I'm thinking kissing in Venice wasn't enough of a send-off, but she's basically like, you help me with my romantic relationship and I'll help you fix yours. She gets reunited with Robin in Gotham, but Two-Face appears, cold cocks Access, leaving Jubilee and Robin to take down Two-Face, which is challenging, but they're able to do it. On the last two pages, they get reunited with Access just as the Scorpion shows up. In issue 3, Batman shows up on the scene, takes down the Scorpion pretty easily, and then scolds both Robin and Access, who convinces Batman to come back to the Marvel Universe with him to figure out the hows and whys of Venom and the Scorpion passing into the DCU without using him as a portal. When Batman goes to the Marvel Universe, I thought it was an interesting sequence where he momentarily spots who he thinks is Catwoman, but it's the Black Cat, and that certainly catches his eye. Because the amalgamated Doctor Strange fate knew of the separate universes and fought to keep them combined, like we were saying before, Axis and Batman break into Doctor Strange's Sanctum Sanctorum, like right through the main symbol window, and Strange has to defend the charges that he's behind it all, but Batman's all, I'm Batman. And Jubilee shows up with the X-Men and has Jean Grey scan Doc's mind and clear him of any involvement, but Batman's not satisfied, so he and Bishop start punching each other, and then Access has to bring in the JLA to help fend off the X-Men. Issue number 4 opens with Access realizing the irony that it's his job to keep the universes separate, and yet by his hand, the JLA is in the Marvel Universe fighting with the X-Men and Doctor Strange. In the middle of the melee, Doctor Strange drops to the floor like he's having a seizure, unconscious, and transforms into Doctor Strange Fate, the self-proclaimed protector of the Amalgam U.
Well, I don't know if you were clued off a few pages earlier, Steve, that something was up, but when Batman's leg grew like twice as long as it was supposed to, that's when I knew there was some kind. I thought he was going to merge with Mr. Fantastic because, I mean, come on. I know I kid, but that panel where he kicks Bishop, like, holy cow. Oh, Butch.
Strange Fate, of course, wants to revive the Amalgam Universe and starts by combining Storm and Wonder Woman into Amazon. Access, then, he teleports himself into the Dark Dimension and finds the real Doctor Strange's astral form imprisoned there by Strange Fate. Strange Fate doesn't want to risk killing Doctor Strange because it's a part of him, so he's kind of unclear how that would affect him. So instead, he has Doctor Strange trapped inside a little Ditko-esque bubble. But with Axis's teleporting powers, Axis just teleports inside the bubble and teleports Doctor Strange's astral form back to face Doctor Strange fate. Which she does, and Strange ends up sparing Strange fate and the entire Amalgam universe inside like a little Franklin Richards Hero Reborn-like orb. And there they can live out their own adventures, and we can go back and visit them anytime. Which is what happened the next week, where we get another week of titles, a return to the Amalgam Age of Comics, with another 12 books, 6 each from Marvel and DC. Here the DC books were Bat-Thing, written by Larry Hama, with art by Rodolfo DiMaggio and Bill Sienkiewicz, and this is a Man-Thing-Man-Bat combo, which I really enjoyed this issue, the story, the art, the whole deal. I particularly like that the deceased middle-level drug dealer is called Fat Freddy, but he doesn't look anything like Gilbert Shelton's Freak Brother character. And then it turns out that that's not Fat Freddy after all, and that ends up being like a linchpin of the mystery that you thought that that was Fat Freddy, but it's not. So it's like, oh, cool, Fat Freddy probably still looks like Fat Freddy somewhere.
Well, he's out getting burned, Steve. He's spending the last of his money on some catnip.
They even mention, like, what's a middle-level drug dealer like Fat Freddy doing selling heroin? That doesn't seem like him. Too funny. Then there was the Dark Claw Adventures. This was written and drawn by Ty Templeton and Rich Burkett, which gives a Batman animated series treatment to the Batman-Wolverine amalgamation. And he has to fight Talia, the Lady Deathstrike, daughter of Ra's Apocalypse.
I thought they did a real good job channeling that Batman the Animated Series vibe and look and feel. Yeah, I thought that one was well done.
Ditto.
But I mean, still made it serious. Like it's kind of brutal. You know, it's not, but it's done in that way that kind of takes the brutality out of it too.
Yeah. The book that was that wasn't one of my favorites, was The Generation Hex, written by Peter Milligan with art by Adam Polina and Mark Morales. It's like a Western-style Generation X team, complete with a Jonah Hex chamber amalgamated character.
I think I actually didn't make it through that one, Steve. Sorry. Might have been one I didn't.
Feel your pain. JLX Unleashed was written by Christopher Priest, a.k.a. Jim Owsley, with art by Oscar Jimenez and Hannibal Rodriguez. This time the team fights Fin Fang Flame. Lobo the Duck, as you mentioned before. Alan Grant, Val Simekis, and Ray Krissing. Enough said. And Super Soldier, Man of War, which again is written by Gibbons and Wade with art by Gibbons and Palmiotti, that gives us a glimpse of the wartime adventures of this Superman-Cap combo, including a Sergeant Rock, Easy Company, Howling Commandos mashup that I really enjoyed. The Marvel books were The Challengers of the Fantastic, written by Carl Kessel with art by Tom Grummett and Al Vey. This Challengers FF combo included a Guardians Watcher combo, the Silver Racer, and a Brainiac Galactus mashup, Galactiac. The exciting X-Patrol was written by Barbara Kessel with art by Brian Hitch and Paul Neary. And they had to fight Brother Brood. And I liked when Pepper Ferris becomes the Madam Sapphire, the Madam Mask, and what is the Sapphire's name?
Star Sapphire.
Star Sapphire, that's it. The Iron Lantern book was written by Kurt Busiek with art by Paul Smith, Al Williamson, and a whole bunch of other inkers. Spider-Boy Team-Up had Roger Stern and Carl Kessel as R.K. Sternsel, themselves amalgamated, with art by LeDron and Juan Velasco, and Team Spider-Boy Up with the Legion of Galactic Guardians 2099. Another Magnetic Men featuring Magneto book written by Tom Payer with art by Barry Kitson and Dan Panosian. And one of my favorites, Thorion of the New Asgods, written by Keith Giffen with art by Romita Jr., that combines Kirby's Asgardians and his new gods.
See, I thought it was Thorion.
Yeah, that works.
But that one was, I thought, very, like, that was JRJR putting in the work, you know, really, really putting it on the page.
Yeah.
And I thought that ended up looking strong. Like, I like him, but sometimes I feel like it can be a mixed bag.
This looked like it was shot right from his pencils because the inking credits were given to Digital Chameleon. So I think it might have just been a, like, jacking up the contrast, you know, on the original pencils. It's raw and Kirby-like, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, like right out of the Eternals, too, I felt. There's, like, a when they do the big kind of looking dudes and everyone's, like, overly muscular and crazy looking, and the dark side Thanos mashup dude looks like he's, like, twice as thick as the Thing.
All of the Amalgam titles were collected into four trade paperbacks: the Amalgam Age of Comics DC Collection, the Amalgam Age of Comics Marvel Collection, Return to the Amalgam Age of Comics DC Collection, you get it, and the Return to the Amalgam Age of Comics Marvel Collection. They're still out there if you can find them. Then in 1997's Green Lantern 87, written by Ron Mars, Axis shows up and meets Jade while looking for Kyle Rayner. But he comes up empty, so he says he's going to go looking for the guy on the surfboard, suggesting the Silver Surfer, which is the book that Mars wrote for Marvel before going to DC and writing Green Lantern. So I like that conceptual continuity. The last we'd hear from these characters would be in the final four-issue limited series for Marvel this time, that spanned 1997 into 1998, called Unlimited Access. And this one really jumped the rails. Written by Carl Kessel, with art by Pat Oliff and Al Williamson. This one has Access as the cause of characters swapping universes. He meets the old bum, the other guardian protector from the alleyway from DC vs. Marvel, and learns that it's an older version of himself, and injects, like, a time travel aspect into this. So now Access is able to pull characters from different eras and swap universes with them. So we get Spider-Man versus Mantis and Wonder Woman versus the Juggernaut. We get the white-templed Hal Jordan Green Lantern versus the less intelligent Hulk. Jonah Hex teaming up with the Two-Gun Kid. The Legion of Superheroes going into the X-Men's Days of Future Past future and fighting the Sentinels.
That part I actually kind of liked, but yeah, it is weird. And I think you touched on it, but just so people know, there's the running backstory is that Axis is very Peter Parker-like with his current girlfriend. So she never believes him. He's late all the time because he's on these missions and everything. So that's kind of some of the running humor slash his story arc in a way.
Yeah.
But
he's also got a girl in the DC universe. Like,
yes,
like he's from the Marvel universe, but he's got something going on the side.
I mean, some of it might have been I just enjoyed seeing the classic Legion characters, because
yeah,
I feel like they haven't had much action. So
agreed.
It was cool seeing Ultra Boy and all those guys just taking on the Sentinels, you know.
They also have vignettes of the Challengers of the Unknown fighting Fing Fang Foom, the Justice Society of America, and the Invaders going into battle together, which was cool. Oh, and they have the original Avengers fighting off in an invasion from Kirby's Fourth World Apocalypse, aided by the classic Justice League. Oh, and the Blue Lightning Superman. Lee. Axis's older self reveals that Access also has the power now to merge heroes. So, at the end of the third issue and into the fourth issue, it features a new wave of Amalgam characters mixed from different times, like the Tim Drake Robin being merged with the original X-Men's Angel, and Captain Marvel Jr. and Captain America, and Jean Grey and the Black Canary. It's not good. The story or the character combinations. This one I was pretty disappointed at.
But he's super amalgamated, Steve.
Access last gets mentioned by Superman in the 1999 Superman Fantastic Four crossover, which was written and drawn by Dan Jurgens and Art Tebert. After Superman learns that a being named Galactus ate Krypton, he mentions Access as someone that he needs to get an expert opinion from. But by the time, a few years later in the 2000s, we finally got the big Justice League Avengers crossover from George Perez that we've been wanting, and he's been wanting since the 80s, no mention of Access, no mention of the brothers, no, none of this. They pretty much wiped it from continuity. And I guess in today's age of movie production companies owning both comic publishers due to the shared nature of this Access character, creators like Ron Marz speculate that we will never, ever, ever see him again. I mean, you thought comics were still about making good comics? Not so much.
Well, I enjoyed reading these, but I'm not going to, you know, shed too many tears about the Access character not coming back. You know, he was more less of a character and more of a plot device. And that's not a big knock on, but I didn't feel like I said, they gave him kind of that Peter Parker thing where he's strangely lucky and yet unlucky with, like you say, he's got two attractive women, yet he can't seem to get it together type of thing. But I couldn't really give you much else about his personality or anything.
It was just like you said, it was a vehicle for being able to have a crossover kind of whenever they wanted to. And I think that first limited series was enjoyable. And part of that was probably that Marz was writing it because he also wrote, you know, one of the Amalgam books, and he wrote half of the DC Marvel versus Marvel. So it kept that same aesthetic and some of that same voicing and everything. But by the time they switched to that last one, it had run its course.
We also feel like it was like a fun idea, but maybe at some point it's kind of run. Like, there's only so many of those mashups that, and then by some point you're like, okay, the joke's kind of done. But I'm not knocking the bit. I just feel like it went on like you say, by the time of the super amalgamated, it's like, yeah, we kind of understand what is going on here, and the novelty had worn off. It's like the new universe. Like, it lasted for a while, or the Ultimate Universe. Like, all these gimmicks that kind of, they're good ideas and they last, but they're not going to ever take over because their entire charm and appeal rely on knowing the originals. You know what I mean? If you don't know the originals and you just handed someone these comics, they'd be okay, but I don't think anyone would be blown away by them.
I could tell that the creators and being friends with Ron, writer Ron Marz, and being able to pick his brain a little bit, I pretty much confirmed that they just had a really good time with this. I mean, Gru and Mike Carlin had worked together for years at Marvel, and then, you know, that was Carlin's resume for coming over to DC to help Marvelize them, you know, after the crisis on Infinite Earths and all that. So I think it was just fun for them to work together again. And some of that enthusiasm really, I think, bled through to the creators. And once those creators weren't involved anymore, some of that, kind of became another project sort of thing. There was just some magic missing that I could tell that everyone was having fun and throwing in the inside jokes and all that stuff. And it didn't come across as much in that last limited series.
Well, even like you say, with the second round where they were able to take the joke even further by mimicking things like Batman the Animated Series. That's almost like a joke within a joke in a way. But and the same with the Lobo the Duck was like, seemed like kind of a next level sort of takeoff on Destroyer Duck. I mean, on Howard the Duck. Sorry. Sorry, Marvel. Please don't get mad at me.
Destroyer Duck. That was a good one.
Supposed to talk about that sort of stuff on Marvel Noise, Steve. I mean, we're really not supposed to.
Yeah, that was Pacific, wasn't it? Pacific Comics or Eclipse? One of those two. But it was Kirby, so we can always talk about Kirby's always fair game. But that was the DC Marvel crossover from the 90s we'll never see it again.
Well, they could do a different... I don't mind those throwaway ones, though, that used to happen every once in a while. You know, where Spider-Man would fight Superman for half an issue, and then they'd eat Hostess pies, or however it resolved itself.
I actually liked those prestige kind of square-bound one-shots that they did in the late 90s. I really enjoyed the Silver Surfer Green Lantern. I very much enjoyed the Batman Captain America one that was like a wartime book that John Byrne did. I thought that was really enjoyable. Like, one of these days I got to go back and revisit some. There was a Galactus and... Was it Galactus and Darkseid?
Yeah, and the one where Galactus tracks down and keeps tabs on Superman when he launches away from Krypton. And yeah, I do think there was some magic to some of those earlier ones, though. Like, and also from the time period you're talking about, I liked it because I'm not that familiar with Kyle Rayner. Like, he was not my Green Lantern. Hashtag not my Green Lantern. Ooh. So it's fun reading about him because, you know, I'm just not. He was a Green Lantern for a very long. I don't know in the current DC, whichever reboot DC's on, who the Green Lantern is, but I like reading his stories because it's just a new character to me.
Boy, would you be surprised if you looked at the Green Lantern's book. There's two of them on Earth now, a guy and a girl. It's wild. But what I like...
Wait, is one of them that the squirrel guy? I like that guy.
Yeah, he was cool. But no, it's not. The thing I liked about the Kyle Rayner Green Lantern was writer Ron Mars was new to DC and new to the DCU, and through a new character's eyes, he got to bop around and explore and experience the DCU, and as someone who was re-getting into the DC comics after years of not reading any comics and then starting back up heavy onto the Marvel stuff and then starting to tease into the DC, it was a nice way to be reintroduced to all of the different DC properties. And if you go through those Kyle Rayner Green Lantern run, which is now, I think there's two trade paperbacks out as they've been just this past year reprinting them, you'll see that there's a lot of guest appearances by characters because it was an opportunity for Mars to play around and check out these different characters and get to write them. And that was a lot of fun. He was very Spider-Man-ish.
It made sense to have someone with a strong creative side because then he can do interesting things with the ring.
Right.
Plus, as you know, Steve, you got to be brave to go through those art school critiques. So that shows he was without fear to face the merciless criticism of his professors for his art projects. Because, you know, I always associate that as a rigorous process for those poor young artists out there. No, I think part of the thing that is very cool about the Green Lantern and to some extent the Nova Corps is the sort of idea of all these kind of intergalactic policemen just kind of being part of a union and like a regular, you know, I always enjoyed those tales where they're just having a beer after their shift is over or whatever.
Sure.
But because you could have, you know, there was the Green Lantern that's a planet, the Ego knockoff. There's, or like I said, the Rocket Raccoon knockoff. I mean, there's just a lot of great characters there.
And the opportunity that those characters might be from different species or planets that are hostile to each other, but now they each have, you know, a person who's a comrade in arms in the Nova Corps or the Green Lantern Corps. That a lot of opportunity for storytelling that I think DC has explored more than Marvel, but neither has really explored to the fullest.
Yes, because you can't possibly ever create a character that uses a tired catchphrase over and over again, you poozer, you know what I mean, in lieu of a swear word. I mean, that's just, does that ever get old, Steve? I mean, you could literally have him say that in every panel of every appearance of his, and you would never tire that. So, I mean, that's something you got.
Didn't they do that in the 2099 universe with shocking this and shocking that?
What the frack, Steve? What the frack? We need a whole episode on comic book swear words.
just the German ones alone that I learned from the old war comics.
Well, I haven't been to the store, but I have a few semi-recent reads and stuff. If you guys want to,
yeah, what do you got?
I gotta get to the store, but I did pick up Oh So Long Ago, Weapon H, Greg Pak, Corey Smith, Marcus Toe, two, Maury Howell.
I'm very curious to hear what you think about this, because it seemed like that Weapon X book was it seemed the whole purpose of the title was to create and push this character and make him into something, and then they put him in another title, and then what do we get?
You get Weapon H. Okay. I was not following his backstory. I decided to go in cold, because I'm like, it'll be a real test of my reading comprehension. I mean, how am I going to be able to figure out the combination of Hulk and Wolverine? I mean, I know that takes a lot for an experienced comic book reader, but I figured I could struggle through.
Is this another amalgam title?
But basically, he's like classic Wolverine and classic Hulk. So he takes from the Hulk the, I want to be left alone, keeping a low profile, I'm going to move locations all the time. And he takes from Wolverine the, you know, I'm the best at what I do. I have a secret dark side and I'm going to kill people. So it's kind of a weird, like, if you like those elements and you haven't got enough of them from reading Hulk and Wolverine, well then, you know, pull up your chair, son. You're going to get a double helping. And
does he flee a lot? Does he flee a lot in the Weapon X book? There was two different storylines with him, and they both ended with him like taking off on the run.
He's kind of doing the Bruce, but like I said, he wants to stay under the radar because his family, you know, he doesn't want them. Unlike the one twist they gave him is he has an existing family, so that makes him separate from Wolverine and Hulk. So in a sense, It gives them that's the spice in the pudding.
Is it like the old Deathlock book where he's like hanging out in the rain outside the apartment that his family lives in and like watching them have Thanksgiving dinner from the roof alley?
Because this is more the Hulk. Like, he's got to keep traveling. He's got to stay under the radar. He's working jobs, cash paid daily. You know, no social security required. Just keep your head down. And then, like all these things, of course, something bad happens, and he has to Weapon H out, Hulk out, Wolverine out, you know, because they give the whole shtick. And it's basically, he looks like a big gray Hulk with kind of bone claws and sort of spikes coming out of him. And, so once that happens, that establishes, then he runs away again. Because, you know, he can't stay in that area because he's been rumbled. But he was trying to keep his head down. But like I said, you know, it's the same in like all those 70s Hulks where like, or remember the Kung Fu TV show, same thing, where he goes to some small town and like the good people are always getting screwed with. And when he shows up, you're not supposed to screw with him. So same kind of thing. So then he has to run away to Alaska. And it's the same kind of thing there where there's some research group. Roxanne drops off a research group. And he's like, oh my God, they're never going to survive up there. And so he won't talk to them, but he leaves them food because he finds out they don't have enough food. Well, what it really turns out, spoiler, Roxanne are bad people. I don't know if you guys know this. And they were up there to create a Wendigo. And you guys know how you create Wendigos.
Oh, boy.
You have to eat a certain type of long pork, I believe, as the pirates used to call it.
Remember that weird, what book was it where the mother was feeding her kids the Wendigo meat to make them into the family of Wendigos? That was nasty.
So the evil Roxanne guy in charge feeds one of them, you know, human jerky. And he turned at the special site.
Would you call
and
me?
And he turns, but he turns into like, not the big, beefy Wendigo that we all know and love, a la Herb Trimpe. Rest in peace. He turns into kind of a... You ever see, like, that Pumpkinhead horror movie? Like, that kind of skeletal, like, long, lanky limbs and long claws and elongated kind of face, which is not... Maybe that's, like, the new Wendigo, or maybe they all look different, but I'm more used to... You know what I mean? Like, the big, beefy kind of Wendigo.
Yeah, a white Sasquatch.
Yeah. So this is more like a werewolfy kind of thing. And so the Weapon H doesn't want to get involved, but of course, like the Kung Fu guy in Hulk, TV Hulk, he has to get involved. And it turns out that the lead Roxxon guy was a robot. And that's how he was protected.
Watch out for the robot, but, Grasshopper.
Yeah. So it's going to be Hulk versus Wendigo. And then it flashes back to the guy's family, the mom and kids, and they work for Roxxon as a little twist. And so she's trying to find out what happened to him. They're trying to look for his family. Dun, dun, dun. There's going to be that running story about, like, you know, if they can identify who he is and his family and everything, that can be leveraged, because obviously who wouldn't want Weapon H on their side? That's, again, leaning on the whole Wolverine thing. Like, if you can use this character as a weapon, who wouldn't want to do that?
It just so it me. Is a... It's not just the Hulk versus Wendigo. It's the Wolverine Hulk versus yes. Wendigo. So, oi. They really checked off their boxes on that one.
Yeah. So I would suggest buying like 100 copies of this. Because I think Kevin can back me up. Isn't Hulk 181 like a valuable back issue? And this is like that combined. This is like all that just in the new comic.
I believe that's a modern book you wouldn't want to throw away.
So that's, I was fine with it. Like, there's nothing, but there's nothing here. While I appreciate them creating, I'm going to use this in the loosest possible sense, a new character, I really feel like, and I understand the creators, look, there's not much reward for creating a new character. The odds of a brand new character making it are slim, and you're much better stowing that character at Image.
Sure. Where
if they make a movie, you make money. So if you're going to make a new character, you're going to make Spider-Gwen. You're just going to make, you know, take a wheel of an existing character and an existing power set and spin the two wheels, and wherever they land, that's your new character.
Like Destroyer Duck.
Yes. So we take... Someone spun the Wolverine wheel and the Hulk wheel and they landed together and they're like, oh, we can do this. And that makes sense. But for me, I feel like that sort of combination, it's not inherently bad or good. It just feels like, what are you doing to make it different?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it appears that the difference here is that this dude's got a family. Not enough. That's not enough of a hook for me yet. Well, it wasn't bad or anything, but it's definitely going to be bombastic over the top. But it also feels not as, I don't know, I feel like Red Hulk did that kind of bombastic over the top thing
yes.
better.
Yes.
And you really have to kind of, it's hard to do because you don't want to be too cheesy, but you have to embrace the sort of ridiculousness of it. And I don't know if they've found the level for that, or at least for me.
And they just a few years ago went through all the trouble of paring down all of these Hulk characters, getting rid of the Red Hulk, getting rid of the Abomination Hulk, you know, the A-bomb and all that. And because there was too many Hulks for a while, to quote the old Ditko Byrne Avengers annual from the early 80s. And again, and there's too many Wolverine characters. Wolverine's been dead and off the board for a few years, but you wouldn't really know it, right? There's so much Wolverine out there. It's like, it's just oversaturating. But if the creator has a story to tell and he's getting the opportunity to tell it, then that's cool.
Yeah.
But this isn't a character I'm looking to stick around or really even interested to see what happens to him, to be honest.
Yeah, like I said, I feel like Red Hulk did this kind of craziness right, and this one isn't quite finding the mark for me, but that doesn't mean it's not for, you know, flip through it, take a look, see what you got. Maybe I'm sure someone's going to find this the perfect level of like, oh yeah, I always wanted Wolverine, but even more powerful. like, or I wanted Hulk but with claws and to really rip people apart. Like, that seems like you can get it all here.
I think you're talking about a teenage or younger desire of pure adrenaline, seeing two crazy characters together. I think that's what you're describing.
Yeah,
but yes, but also with that, like, you have to have that reluctance, like that. I don't want to kick your butt. Please don't make me, because if you know, you wouldn't like me when I'm angry. Type. You need that. Not that he's into it, but that he's withdrawn from it. And I think that was maybe the difference with the Red Hulk, because he didn't have that. He was fully happy to kick your butt and with a smile on his face.
He'd even shoot you with a gun, right? When the whole mystery of who is this Red Hulk that lasted for so long. Well, to go back to the DC Marvel, this character in his power set and everything seems a lot like Doomsday. You know, he's like a bony, sharp-edged, big, giant Hulk-class character.
Yes, Doomsday is an excellent visual cue, Steve.
But he's got right a family. But he's a family man.
Well, that's to give him, I guess, more emotion. Well, it is, and it's different than Hulk and... Well, I mean, Hulk had Betty at some point, that's right. In fact, during your delightful crossover, that was a time when he was Hulk with intelligence and Betty.
Yeah.
So that was a nice one. I also picked up the Johnny Blaze Ghost Rider number one. Because, you know, part of it was, you see that Phil Noto on a book, and I don't know about you two, but I like to at least look at it, you know? I think Kevin likes Noto, too.
Yeah, is that a Damnation one-shot, or is that...
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Christopher Sabila, and then Phil Noto, like, that's enough to get me going.
Both of them. I really like Sabila's stuff.
So, this is kind of a... Feels like a slightly different. The last long time Noto I remember was didn't he do quite a few issues of that Black Widow a few years back?
He did.
And maybe some work in the Star Wars universe, if I'm not mistaken? Yeah.
I think that's where he disappeared to after Black Widow, but I really liked his work on the Black Widow. This one, I feel like, I don't know, while I enjoy Phil Noto, and I guess he does his own colors,
right.
I feel like the palette doesn't, because he's in hell, so it's just all this like red and orange kind of washing over everything. And I get the point, like he's in hell, but I feel that makes the image less dynamic.
Yeah.
And like I said, I hate saying, because I really did, that Black Widow stuff I think was beautiful. And maybe he did the same thing there, but it just feels like, I don't know, it just kind of washes it out in a way.
If you're going to be in hell, you better be drawing some intricate backgrounds. That's all I got to say. Because otherwise it is. You're just talking about a lot of red. And, you know, think of like an Eric Larson or anything that Joe Sinnott inked, where you just get a lot of good rocks and structures. And, I mean, that's hell.
Well, also, the characters don't pop out of the background, I feel, when you use that much of a tone over everything sometimes. And so, I mean, a little bit of Ghost Rider and Johnny Blaze are separated, so they have to agree to work together. And so the Ghost Rider's flame sticks out a little bit, but not as much as I would have liked with a bit of a different color treatment. God, I feel like such a jerk being so critical. But in a sense, say it's a bad job. It was just because I have him in such high regard. You know, it's almost like someone you really like when you feel like they're not doing their best, even though it's better than a lot of other people at their best.
Well,
you just feel a little disappointed or like it could be so much better.
One of the things I love about Noto's work is how much he's able to bring forth warmth on like his skin tones and his faces by doing a little bit of red around the nose and around the cheeks a little bit. And he makes flesh look vascular, and sometimes it brings out, like I said, real warmth from the characters, whether it's a good feeling, whether it's a pretty girl or a male character who's beaten and bruised, but you feel the heat coming off of these characters. Now, you stick them in hell, and where, you know, you're in an environment that's pushing heat onto everything, and I think, and I haven't read the issue, but I can imagine how that particular aspect of his work that I very much enjoy would be lost in the palette.
Yes, when you have like a reddish face and a reddish background, there's a difference, but it's very subtle, and I feel like it does kind of wash it out in a little way. But basically, he makes a gauntlet run, the two of them, through hell to get to the inner circle, and it's an interesting, the two of them discussing their sort of relationship and how they're, you know, what if each of them get out of this partnership, and are they going to work together? If you like Johnny Blaze and what makes him and what makes the Ghost Rider character,
Johnny Blaze, will he ever win?
But in this case, he ends up in a superior position. But yeah, I just feel like I did not know this was a one shot. Thanks, Kevin, for ruining it for me.
Well, I didn't want you to continue going to the comic shop and going, I didn't get that number two. Where is it?
So is Doctor...
Oh, you know, I only get there once a month.
Is Doctor Strange not in the issue?
He's not in this one.
Hmm.
No, this is all Johnny Blaze making the run to get to this point in hell where he can get set up as one of the Dukes or one of the Inner Rings. And part of the other problem is, while we're doing our Marvel DC thing, is, man, that Neil Gaiman did a pretty nice setup of a hell, of a comic book hell. And he was able to give enough specificity to build it to be realistic. What Marvel's hell always had going for it, I thought, was they didn't give you a lot of detail. You would just see Mephisto, and they kept him mysterious, which I liked. But then Gaiman comes around and lays out this very... with just some really nice stories and depth and intrigue and palace intrigue as the different demons and dukes battle it out and everything. So I just can't help but make some slightly he did a good job, man.
My favorite Marvel hell wasn't even real. It was the Nightcrawler's Inferno hell that Margalai Santos, of the Winding Road, set up back in an old X-Men annual. It was one of Romita Jr.'s first works, and Bob McLeod beautifully inked it. And it was the one where Nightcrawler, like, dies, and Doctor Strange brings the X-Men into hell, and it's Dante's hell. You get the different rings with the different punishments, and, man, that's some good hell.
and so I feel like it's interesting, and you see a cameo from some dead characters that we all know and love.
Uncle Ben?
There's a certain another Spider-Man character that's more beloved than Uncle Ben. A crime lord. Known for wearing a certain type of mask.
Now you want to help.
Gwen Stacy?
You sent the kid who collected Spider-Man comics to hell.
Ben
Reilly?
The Rose.
Sergeant Bloom? Wasn't he the Rose?
Is he wearing his mask in hell?
Yeah, he's wearing his mask, gosh. And he has the Rose in his lapel.
Oh, that's too funny.
And one of the jack-o'-lanterns. You know, because there's been like 100 of them, so whichever one died in there. So that part's fun, too. Like, he has a little cameo with some of the dead. I mean, I'm sure, as Kevin pointed out, the poor young kid who died.
Well, look how...
he's probably somewhere in the background, but I didn't see him.
Look how far they had to reach to find a character who's still dead.
Well, I really always enjoyed those...
Ned Leeds!
Like, the Rose versus Kingpin and Tombstone and Hammerhead and all those kind of gang boss stories are always fun for me.
At some point, and I know it would take a lot of research on our end to do it any justice, even though we would never be able to do it complete, but we should do a Crime Lords of the Marvel Universe and go through some of those wacky characters, from the Rose to who was the big heavy slug guy to the Owl to... There was so many. Silvermane, and we could go on, and we should someday.
I also stole my slug joke.
I also broke down today, and I had not bought a Marvel Legends figure since Moon Knight, but today I had to pick up Songbird. I was in Target.
Yeah.
And I'd been so good about not buying, but I saw her on the shelf, and I'm like, dig dang it, I'm a Thunderbolts guy. How can I pass up Melissa?
That is a good fig.
I think the sculpt is nice. Shelf. I think the wing, like, I just think it was also well done. And I'm super curious. I have half a Thanos from some earlier wave, and I wonder if I can Frankenstein these Thanos parts with the ones I already have.
They usually do the pins, like, different sizes to make it difficult to Frankenstein them up, but there's occasionally you can find, you know, they only have so many settings, so.
Because I've never finished a build of fig.
What? Really?
Yeah, I've never gotten a whole wave. Because I only buy the ones that tickle my fancy. So I never finished a wave. Because there's always some, like on this one, the movie Captain America, I have no interest in.
Right.
Yep.
And also, as Kevin pointed out, I think it's a cool character, but the Proxima Midnight looks a little weird.
Agreed. Oh, yeah. I assume in the movie they look right off model, so it might look good in the movie, but whenever I see pictures of the figure, I'm just like, what isn't working there?
Yep.
And then
the lighting.
I was somewhat tempted by the Cobra, because I do like the Serpent Society.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And he looks like a pretty good fig, but I was like, nah, if I'm going to break down and get something, it's going to be Melissa, not the Cobra.
I've been getting
Taskmaster. You can always get.
I've been getting the Serpent Society releases when they come out, but when I see the Cobra, I still think he's got to be standing next to Mr. Hyde.
I agree. They are the class, and then have like a Kirby Thor design next to him, and have that's a three pack.
That's surprised. I've never done a Hyde.
Yeah.
I know he's just a guy in a suit. Maybe that's not visually appealing.
Agreed.
Well, I think the problem is also he's not a common build. Like, his shape is not, like, most of these are modular, right? They're just,
sure,
they have like a woman's arm, and they, you know, or like three different arms, and it's got to be, and he's like a funny shape, because he's, the ones I like are when from like the Thunderbolts run, where it's kind of got kind of a smaller head on a oversized body type of thing.
It's kind of hunched over.
And I think you'd have to have a new fit, right? You'd have to do a new torso, and I don't think they want to pay to create a new, you know, all those new parts.
Or buy the mold for Solomon Grundy from DC to make their Hyde figure. Hey, that's another thing we should do down the line, is do another block of old Daredevil masterworks, because there's some real good Stan and Gene Colan stuff that was on deck when we stalled on that stuff that I would love to read.
Yeah, I think I continued reading for another volume or two, but then I think my Spider-Man reading got in the way.
All right, you're in then.
Well, I'm trying to be the Daredevil guy, but that's a little difficult.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, after you're purportedly being the Thunderbolts guy, I don't know if you can switch teams, Kevin. But, and I also picked up a couple of cheap sub-$10 slabs, if you guys are curious what less than $10 slabs equal. Okay, first up, the highest grade, Electro Assassin number 8 from 1987. Beautiful Bill Sienkiewicz cover, 9.2.
Wow, there were 8 of those? Wow. Is that the last issue? Was there 8? Is it 8 of 8?
Yeah, it's 8 of 8.
Wow, I didn't realize that it was that long of a series.
It's from the Epic line.
Yeah.
And for those of you who are young, Epic used to be a separate imprint from Marvel.
How
I also have, I have a number 1 comic, guys. Punisher Volume 2, number 1.
Really?
Volume 2?
Yeah, this is an 8.5. It's from 98.
Huh.
Christopher Golden.
Oh, so it's Stephen Grant?
No. Bernie Wrightson cover.
Oh, yeah. It's
not
the Marvel Knights. It's the limited series where he's the angel, right?
Oh.
Yeah, but not, I don't know, like, we all love Bernie Wrightson, but yes, that is probably not his, not what I would say is his peak work.
You don't think
I feel like he could have done something.
You don't think of the Punisher when you think of Bernie Wrightson?
Yeah, I mean, so, and then the last book is a 6.0 League of Extraordinary Gentlemen number 5.
What?
From 2000.
Too funny.
That's rather random.
America's Best Comics. Well, what happens is I tend to bid on a lot of books in the cheap range before we officially started recording. As I told Kevin, I put in a $20 bid on an Amazing Fantasy 15. Apparently that's not winning the auction.
Plus, you're a big Kevin O'Neill guy, so I understand the League book.
And it's weird, because I never picked up those floppies, because in 2000 I was just starting to get back in. So, and this would not have been, I would have been looking for Martial Law for Kevin O'Neill. So it would have totally missed my radar at the time. So it's nice to have a floppy of it, because I just didn't, you know, I since have it in, like, different trades. And I've gotten him to sketch in a couple of them, because, you know, those European guys, when they sign, they also do a little sketch on the inside. So I have two Kevin O'Neill sketches and two of my League of Extraordinary Gentlemen books. So I will not be trading those in for fancy new hardcovers at any point.
Nice.
You know, they got little sketches in them, and he is such a fun guy. So, but not a lot of Marv work, except for, I guess you'd consider the first Martial Law. It was from Epic Comics, even though the recent omnibus came out from DC. I think it's technically Marvel, right? We consider Epic Marvel.
Yeah, it counts. Hey, I had the pleasure of corresponding with and scoring some great pieces from Will Mineo, and just this past week, and I scored this wonderful... it's like a 9x12, very colorful Firestar, because Will Mineo worked on the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends animated cartoon from our youth. And with that same purchase, I got a bunch of stats of the storyboards from a Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends episode that Mineo had done. And Kevin, wouldn't you know, it's the one with the swarm. It's so cool. Seeing the notes in the margins to the animators about what's going on with the swarm as they attack him or he attacks out is really funny.
Whenever I go up to Van Eaton Auction, I always look at the old Marvel animation cells and look at the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends and the Fantastic Four series, and because they always have Galactus, all these other...
Cool.
That 90s Iron Man cartoon. And so is he related to Sal Mineo, the actor from like Rebel Without a Cause and all that?
I don't know. Is it spelt like Mignot?
No.
Okay. Well, this is Will Mineo, who probably most memorable to guys our age from the DN Agents series from...
Oh, I love that.
Eclipse,
yeah.
With Mark Evanier. My mistake. But yeah, he bounced back from, you know, from animation to comics to do things at various times, and nobody draws a girl like Mineo.
No, that DNA Agents was definitely pitched to the young men in the audience.
I mean, nowadays, it's so many years later, you know, that I would guess that he has sold off, like, the really good pages that he has from DN Agents. But what he does for, or at least he did for a couple of these pages that I bought from him from DN Agents, have, you know, are more in-between type scenes. But on the back, he draws these amazing things on the back of them that then all of a sudden makes them a piece of art that, like, I gotta have. So I've got this DN Agents page, and then you flip it over, and it's this amazing, very busy, great drawing of Rainbow and the other characters. All, it's just fantastic.
Really, well, if you cool. correspond with him again, tell him I'm a big fan of the DNA Agents. That was a great series.
Will do. Me too. One of my favorites. I read a collection that came out recently that, as a fan of Kazar and Shanna, I really dug. It was Marvel Masterworks Kazar Volume 2, which includes material from 1973 and 1974, and that's Astonishing Tales 17-20, Shanna the She-Devil 1-5, Kazar 1-5, and Daredevil 110-112. It's over 350 pages, folks. Now, these Jungle comics aren't the deepest, most introspective comics in Marvel's stable, so the introductions by Mike Friedrich from Star Reach is basically how he got into the biz, scored the gig writing some of these stories, and then mostly about how he met and worked with Steve Gerber. Similar for Carol, wife of Phil Suling's intro text piece. It's how she got into the biz, got the Shanna gig, and how she met Steve Gerber. Astonishing Tales 17-20 was from 1973, written by Mike Friedrich, with art by Dan Adkins, Jim Starlin, Marie Severin, Frank Chiaramonte, Jack Abel, and Frank Giacoa. The arc could have been called Kazar Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., as it stars Kazar and S.H.I.E.L.D. agent Bobby Morse, who we now know as Mockingbird, banging around New York City, sent on a mission by Nick Fury to recover or secure a super soldier serum created by an AIM scientist. Standing in their way is the Zodiac Clan's Gemini, Kazar's brother the Plunderer, and the teleporting alien monster Gog, originally from Amazing Spider-Man 103 when Spidey teamed up with Kazar. Plus, there's plenty of AIM beehive goons to be knocked around. The scientist responsible for this version of the super soldier formula ingests it himself during a S.H.I.E.L.D. raid and becomes Victorious the Conqueror, leaving plenty of room for dialogue comparing the chemical-produced strength of Victorious and the natural might of Kazar. Oh yeah, they go there. The fight scenes with Gemini are the best of the bunch here, I think, and it's always fun to see Bobby Morse running around in her go-go-style dress and boots. Shanna the She-Devil issues 1-5 also hit the stands over the course of 1973, written by Carol Suling and Steve Gerber, with art by George Tuska and Ross Andrew, with the heavy-handed inks you'd expect from a Vinnie Coletta. Oh, there's these striking Steranko covers on Shanna issues number 1 and 2 also. The first ish has Shanna dealing with zoo-kept big cats being slaughtered, shot, in their pens, and also tells her origin story, explaining her dislike of both guns and the uncivilized, civilized world in general. She also brings back the surviving cubs, Eenie and Beery, back into the wild, and they become her sidekick pet Zabu types. The second dish has Shanna in the Sahara, facing human slave traffickers after she's tipped off by a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. Also introduces her pal Game Warden Patrick McShane, whose favorite sport is admittedly Shanna watching. Mine too. In issue number 3, Shanna encounters a Minoan tribe carrying on their version of Crete's culture, teasing writer Carol Suling's love of ancient languages. And issue 4 has Shanna versus the Mandrill, and issue 5 versus Necra, who really needs to get some sun. Kazar finally got his own series at the end of 1973, and these first 5 issues, written by Mike Friedrich, have Kazar and Zabu returning to the Savage Land, giving readers some Savage Land history along the way, and uniting Kazar and Shanna when they both end up captured in their respective domains by Malgado the Red Wizard. Kazar gives the seemingly frail Shanna little respect at first, but quickly figures out that she is a worthy partner, and even asks her to stay in the Savage Land at the end of issue 2, but she bolts because she still has baggage. She's got a personal mission to complete, finding her missing father. Kazar issues 3 and 5 sees S.H.I.E.L.D. agent Bobby Morse traveling to the Savage Land. Her and Kazar, they had some chemistry, and she's alerting Kazar of and helping Kazar deal with the threat of Magor, the man-god. The art on these 5 issues is by Dandy Don Heck, Paul Reinemann, Mike Royer, Jack Abel, and Mike Esposito. And these issues also include some Savage Land maps and Kazar's lair, like a schematic of where he lives, by Mike Royer. Daredevil issues 110 to 112 from 1974 were written by Steve Gerber, with pencils by Bob Brown and Gene Colan, and inks by Franks Chiramonti and Giacoa and Jim Mooney. And they're included in this collection because they wrap up the loose threads from Shanna's title, with the Mandrill, Necra, who have both now teamed up with the Silver Samurai, and the whole bit with Shanna's long-lost father, whom she learns at the beginning of this tale was murdered and now needs to avenge. It's a great collection, even though it is, for lack of a better word, soft comics from the early 70s. Even includes some excerpts from the Marvel Team-Up and Marvel 2-in-1 issues around that time that have The Thing and Daredevil and start to deal with the events that lead into his team-up with Shanna in 110 to 112. Now, there should be one more volume of Marvel Masterworks that cover the rest of this Kazar series. I think it went up to about issue 20, I want to say, maybe 18, something along those lines. But then after that, they should finally be getting to my beloved Bruce Jones, Brent Anderson, Kazar the Savage series from the early 80s that is near and dear to my heart and has only been reprinted. They did a trade paperback, I think just a couple of years ago now, of the first four or five issues, and that's it. But that stuff is great. The different races that he meets on the other side of the Savage Land, the winged airy folk, the crossing paths with Belasco, all the mind games he does on Shanna, and eventually going to New York, and Shanna and Peter Parker sort of having a little bit of a romance when they think Kazar is dead. All that stuff is really good. Love that series, and can't wait to see it finally reprinted, maybe in a year or two? At this rate. But hey, glad to have a Kazar Marvel Masterworks at all. So, that's another episode of Marvel Noise, this one being a long time coming. We'll try to get back on track here and back to our bi-weekly schedule. Until then, think spring, and until Kazar and Shanna pave over the Savage Land and put up a parking lot, make mine Marvel. Later! We'll be right back.
You're my